White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and students of the International Jew. It is Thursday, July 18th, and I am Carolyn Yeager. And Hadding Scott is not here with me yet. This is the first time that he hasn't appeared to do the show, and I hope there's nothing wrong. I sent him an email a little bit ago, but I've also noticed that his Skype is not open. So something is going on. I don't know what. I'll just carry on myself. I am not as good a reader as Hadding, but I will do my best, and maybe he will just come on sometime during the show. Anytime he might pop up. At least I hope that there's not any. Otherwise, there's something that's happened for him. I don't know what. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a fantastic chapter tonight with lots of great stuff in it. And, so it's kind of long too. So I'm just going to go right ahead with it. And I'll try to remember to say after a little bit of time goes by that I'm reading it because Hadding does not happen to be here yet tonight. This is chapter 51. Will Jewish Zionism bring Armageddon? When the British Army passed into Jerusalem in the memorable capture of the city in 1917, the protocols went in with it. A symbolic circle was thus closed, though not in the way the protocolists had hoped. The man who carried the protocols knew what they signified, and they were carried not in triumph, but as the plans of the enemies of world liberty. Now, I asked the question who, but throughout this whole chapter, I don't believe that's ever been answered. So I kind of don't like it that they suggest this, that somebody took. I don't know if this is. I'm not real clear what this is supposed to mean. That just somehow the protocols were in effect. What the mission of the protocols described was in effect when this British Army won the Battle of Jerusalem and went into the city in 1917. That's all I can figure on that. But there was a Battle of Jerusalem at that time, and that's when the General Allenby was the victorious one, and they beat the Ottomans, the Turks, who had been in control of Jerusalem in 1917. So to continue, Zionism is the best advertised of all present Jewish activities and has exerted a greater influence upon world events than the average man realizes. In its more romantic aspects, it makes an appeal to Christian as well as to Jew, because there are certain prophecies which are held to concern the return of the Jews to Jerusalem. When this return takes place, certain great events are scheduled to ensue. Because of this admixture of the religious sentiment, it will be rather difficult for a certain class of people to scrutinize modern political Zionism. They have been too well propagandized into believing that political Zionism and the return promised by the prophets are the same thing. Having succumbed to the initial confusion of mistaking Judah for Israel, they have entirely mistaken the ancient writings that relate to these two and have made the single tribe of Judah, whence comes the name Jew, the hub around which all history and humanity swing. Judah was the tribe with which Israel could not live in peace over 2,000 years ago, and which has the fateful gift of stirring up the same kind of dissension today. And yet no one ever thought of thought of charging the 10 tribes of Israel with anti-Semitism. You know, I believe here their writers are coming up with their ideas that the only real the part of Israel that was that is what the Jews that trouble us today was the tribe of Judah. That seems to be what they're saying, which is not Christian identity. I don't know if it had anything to do at the time with British Israel, or whether it doesn't fit with either one of those, with that one either. I can't say. And I'll just go on. Zionism is challenging the attention of the world today because it is creating a situation out of which many believe the next war will come. To adopt a phraseology familiar to students of prophecy, it is believed by many students of world affairs that Armageddon will be the direct result of what is now beginning to be manifested in Palestine. For these, if for no other reasons, the subject becomes important. With Zionism as a dream of pious Jews, this article has nothing to do. With Zionism as a political fact, every first-class government is now compelled to have something to do. It is a bigger question than the German indemnities or American immigration because it lies back of both and is rapidly proceeding under cover of both. It is worthy of note, if only in passing, that Zionism, in the active modern political sense, took its rise racially and geographically where Bolshevism arose, namely in Russia, and that its center, the seat of its interaction committee, was at Berlin. There was always a close relationship between the Zionists of Russia and the New York Kehila, as is evidenced by the public utterances made in Russia after the revolution, in which the Kehila is extolled. You know, we were reading the last 2 weeks about the New York Kehila, and they connect it. The international Jew connects it with the revolution in Russia for sure, and with and ties it in with Bolshevism, as you remember if you listened to those programs. At the time the war was declared in 1914, that is what became the World War I, the Interactions Committee, that's the one they said was centered in Berlin, was spread about in various countries. For example, Dr. Shmaria Levin of Berlin was in the United States and remained here. He was Russian rabbi, German scholar, and cosmopolitan. Although his headquarters were Berlin, he remained in the United States and became recognized as the leader of the leaders of Zionism, the leader of the leaders of Zionism, until the great Jewish shift to Versailles. Another member of the Interactions Committee was one Jacobson, who was in Constantinople. When he saw that Constantinople could no longer be the center of Zionist politics, he left and went to Copenhagen, Denmark, where in a neutral country he could be of practical usefulness to the Zionists by transmitting information and funds. That is a quote from Guide to Zionism, page 80. I don't know where you, you know, they don't say anything more than that it's a guide to Zionism. I didn't look it up, but anyway, there's another quote further on down from that same book or booklet. the entire Inner Actions Committee, with headquarters at Berlin, moved freely through a war-locked world, the only exceptions being Warburg, singular, and Hantke, H-A-N-T-K-E, and there was no need for the Berlin Warburg to move about, for there were others who represented him. Dr. Levin gave his sanction for the shifting of the center of Jewish gravity from Berlin to America, and, quote, as early as August 30th, 1914, a month after the outbreak of war, an extraordinary conference of American Zionists was called in New York, unquote. This may also come from that, doesn't say, but it might also come from Guide to Zionism. I don't know. What this change of seat meant has formed the subject of much discussion. The change from Berlin to was it New York or the or Versailles? Anyway, I'm confusing myself here as I'm reading. I've lost my place now. Huh, this is not easy. I shouldn't be commenting, I should just read. I'm way up here. That's what it was called in New York. Dr. Levin, what this change of seat meant has formed the subject of much discussion. In 1914, the Jews apparently knew more about the probable duration of the war than did the principals. It was not to be a mere excursion through Belgium, as some fancied. There was time to dicker, to show the value of certain Jewish support to the governments. Germany gladly pledged the land of Palestine to the Jews, but the Jew had already seen what Wilhelm, that is the German Kaiser, had done in that ancient state when he enthroned himself on the Mount of Olives. Evidently, the Allies won the contest of making promises, for on November 2, 1917, when General Allenby was pushing up through Palestine with his British army, Arthur James Balfour, the British Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, issued the famous declaration approving Palestine as a national home for the Jewish people. I have a quote here from probably Wikipedia that says, Balfour was keenly aware of the presence of an indigenous Arab population, but in an era that preceded international law, the United Nations Charter and the Fourth Geneva Convention, a powerful empire had no qualms about granting a land deed for territories it had no legitimate claim to. Well, I liked that because I think that, in general, the British, that's how the British felt at the time, and they thought that they had the right to say that Palestine could be made into a national home for the Jewish people, when they really didn't have any right to do that at all. But there was nobody to stop them. Nobody did stop them. Quote, here's another quote from Guide to Zionism, pages 85 to 86. The wording of it came from the British Foreign Office, but the text had to be revised in the Zionist offices in America as well as in England. The British declaration was made in the form in which the Zionists, in which the Zionists desired it, and the last clauses were added in order to appease a certain section of timid anti-Zionist opinion. Now, please read the declaration and note the italicized clauses just referred to, that is the appeasing the timid anti-Zionist opinion. It says, Her Majesty's government's view with favor, Her Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of non-Jewish communities in Palestine and here's the important part, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. So they're saying that that's where the little revisions were made by the Zionists in America and England in this declaration, so that they wouldn't lose anything. By gaining Palestine, they wouldn't lose anything in any other country. Now, to go on, Zionism is of particular interest, not merely because of the quarrels which have arisen among the leaders over money. It is the war of interest against capital, but also because of the light it throws on the two great armies of Jews in the world, the way in which they use their power where they can, and the trouble that always embroils the nations which become Jewish tools. I like that. The trouble which always embroils the nations which become Jewish tools. That's for sure. That's what we are here in the United States. Who else is? All of Europe, Germany. Who knows who else? I can't think, think who to say right at the moment. But to go on, people sometimes ask why Jewry, which is capitalistic, should favor Bolshevism, which is the announced enemy of capital. It is an interesting question. Why should a New York Jewish financier, an officer of the government of the United States, help finance a red publication which even our tolerant government cannot stomach? In addition to the fact that it is only Gentile capital that is attacked, the answer is that the Jew who has fallen for the worship of the golden calf is anxious to keep in the good graces of the Jew of the East, the Mongolian Jews, who are rampaging against orderly systems of society. It is quite useful when there is a revolution in Paris to have the 600 houses which you may own spared by the incendiary mobs, as were Rothschild's houses. Zionism has been one of the subjects upon which Western and Eastern Jew can unite. Indeed, it was the Eastern Jew that compelled the Western Jew to take a favorable stand on this matter, on the matter of Zionism, they mean. The Jewish gentlemen who are receiving the freedom of our cities today in their various aspects of as German and British scientists are Eastern Jews. They have come to a contest with the Jews of America on the question of money. The Jews of America have smothered some very ugly charges. The Jews of the East, more recently of Germany or England, are not likely to be browbeaten by the money bags of Jewish New York, for the Eastern type of Jew knows of a situation in which money is the most useless thing in the world, and that is why he is feared and favored by Western Jewry of the golden calf. So they're saying that Western Jewry is all about money and making money, but Eastern Jewry, which are even among whom are the Jews, are Jews of Germany and England, which can be a little confusing here, are the revolutionaries, and they have come from the East. Analysis offer any possible thoughts about that. But I will say that I wrote a note here to myself that that we need to analyze this a little bit. But that one thing is that Jewish immigrants from the East have influence over the money type Jews because I'm saying because they are anarchists. You know, the Eastern and what he said, Mongolian and so on Jews, are anarchists, and they can even burn down and destroy that which they're calling the Western Jews, own and care about. So they're afraid of him too, in a sense, but they have joined together. So to continue, the Jewish defenders are just now capitalizing the split in Jewry. The real split will come when Jews of wisdom begin to support the attempts which have been made to liberate the Jews from their leaders. See, now here they're still hoping. We've mentioned this many times. It comes up where the international Jew is looking forward to the time when the Jews wake up and stop following these leaders, you know, and start realizing that it's not in their best interest. But this, as we know, has never happened still today. So this was written in 1921. And we're still, I don't think that's going to, I don't look forward to that happening myself. This internal squabble means nothing but a squabble of leaders. But when the Jews themselves divide, one side for 20th century light and the destruction of the class power of selfish leaders, then may we look up hopefully. When the Jew recognizes the honesty of his critics, that means people like the international Jew, and the righteousness of what they charge, then will there be a split, but not before. The division in Jewry, as evidenced by the contempt of the Revolutionary Party for the Financial Party, and as even more strongly evidenced by the fear of the Revolutionary Party by the Financial Party, is being brought about by the insincerity of the Western Jews' Zionism. The Western Jew says that the United States is the promised land. Profits and interest are the milk and honey, and New York is Jerusalem. But the Jew of Russia has another view. A knowledge of political Zionism is worthwhile also as an authoritative illustration of what the Jew does when he is in power. Heretofore, there has been Russia to illustrate this, but now there is Palestine. With every fact against them, with every traveler and observer giving them the lie direct, there are still Jewish spokesmen and poor, befuddled Gentile fronts who insist that Bolshevism is not Jewish and that Russia is not now governed by Jews. It is just this constant denial of facts, this failure to use their opportunity to be honest, that is going to be the judgment of Jewish leaders. Bolshevism all over the world, not in Russia only, but in New York, in Chicago, in New Orleans, in San Francisco, is Jewish. So this is one of the very big statements they make in this chapter, in my opinion, and that is that Bolshevism all over the world is Jewish, and there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And of course, Zionism is Jewish too. However, there is no need further to insist upon that, except occasionally to add confirmatory illustrations of it. More to the present point is Palestine. It will be very difficult for the most irresponsible Jewish spokesman to deny that Palestine is Jewish. The government is Jewish. The plan of procedure is Jewish. The methods used are Jewish. Does anyone rise to deny that? Scarcely. Very well. Palestine will do to illustrate the genius of the Jew when he comes to power. Professor Albert T. Clay in the Atlantic Monthly, will anyone declare that this long-established and thoroughly respectable Boston publication is anti-Semitic? They ask. Clay warns us that the information about Palestine, which we receive in America, comes to us through the Jewish Telegraph Service, which is the Associated Press of Worldwide Jewry. I thought that was interesting. And the Zionist propaganda. The latter, he says, with its harrowing stories of pogroms in Europe and its misrepresentations of the situation in the Near East, has been able to awaken not a little sympathy for the Zionist propaganda. This propaganda of pogroms, thousands upon thousands of Jews killed, amounts to nothing except as it illustrates the gullibility of the press. Thousands upon thousands of Jews killed is in quotes, like, you know, that's what the propaganda is saying. No one believes this propaganda, and governments regularly disprove it. But the fact that it continues indicates that something besides facts is necessary to keep the scheme going. Well, that made me think of the current Trayvon Martin situation, that we have, we have propaganda that doesn't fit reality, but they just, you know, they just keep it going. In Jerusalem, as this is being written, martial law is proclaimed. There has been a struggle between the native inhabitants, whom the Balfour Declaration sought to protect, and the new-come Jews. As in the famous Easter disorders of the last year, the wounded in the hospitals show that the Jews were armed and the natives fought with whatever weapons they could find on the spot. The conclusion of all impartial observers under the circumstances being that the Jews prepared for and sought the fight with unprepared natives. The mark of disorder perpetrated by the Jews is all over the place. The persecuted turned persecutor. And lest this should be charged to the general wildness of the people in Palestine, let it be said that the rioters were only expressing in deeds what cultivated American and English Jews have expressed in words, namely that the lawful inhabitants of the land ought to be driven out in spite of governmental promises to the contrary. One of the first Easter rioters, Jabotinsky, you know, I'm familiar with this man. I can't think of his first name, though. What is his first name? But anyway, he's the founder of the Irgun Party. He was one of the first rioters, whom the British authorities sentenced to 15 years in prison, was released immediately upon the arrival of Sir Herbert Samuel. Now, we've talked about him in the past on this program, and is now traveling in state and is talked of as a possible successor to Sir Herbert, although he is originally one of the Russian Bolsheviki come down to practice the gentle arts of that tribe in Palestine. Yeah, Jabotinsky's from Russia, where he learned his trade. The government is Jewish. Sir Herbert Samuel is High Commissioner, representing the power of the British government, which holds the mandate over Palestine. The head of the Judicial Department, who appoints the judges of Palestine, is a Jew. Christian or Muslim judges who do not give the Jews a shade the better of the proceedings, are ousted, a condition not unknown in New York. Chaim Weizmann is head of the Department of Works. He's a well-known Jewish leader in Palestine and Israel. He is a Jew, now traveling in this country, and having the polite lie passed to him occasionally by Judge Julian W. Mack. Well, I thought I'd look up Mack, and so I have this to say from his obituary. An exponent of democracy in Jewish community life, as well as in national affairs, Judge Mack was an ardent supporter of the American Jewish Congress, and upon its formation in 1917, was elected its first president. He was the first chairman of the Committee of Jewish Delegations at the Versailles Peace Conference in 1919, which secured national minority rights for Jews in European countries. Since 1914, he has been closely identified with the Zionist movement and was the president of the Zionist Organization of America from 1918 to 1921, later becoming its honorary president And he twice visited Palestine and was, you know, had something there, a colony named in his honor. All right, that's Julian W. Mack, a typical New York Jew, I would say. Jewish leader, I would say. In fact, as the heads of all departments are Jews, a former New York Jew being head of the Department of Immigration, who has made splendid rules for the protection of Palestine from an undesirable class of Jews, rules so well adapted for the purpose that if the Congress of the United States should adopt them, the cry of persecution would girdle the world. That is, he's protecting Palestine, Jewish Palestine, from undesirable Jews, but if we were to do it in our country, if we would try to protect our country from undesirable Jews, the cry of persecution would be heard loud and clear. Continuing, it is to be noted that the Jewish government of Palestine is very much like that of Russia, mostly foreign. Trotsky came from the east side of New York. Now, I don't know why they say that, because I have read that so many times, and I thought that Trotsky, being his name being Leon Braunstein or Lev Braunstein, was born in New York and grew up there and then went to Russia, but it's not true. He was born in Russia and he grew up in Russia and he was involved in all kinds of this Bolshevik stuff in Russia. And he came to New York right before, what year was that? Anyway, he came to New York just and spent 2 or 3 months on the east side of New York. And then he went back to Russia because the revolution was breaking out. So anyway, that's that little thing I added in there about him. So continuing with the chapter, a gentleman recently released from Bolshevik custody, speaking about Trotsky. A gentleman recently released from Bolshevik custody told the writer that the governor of his prison was an ordinary Jew who formerly lived on 14th Street, Detroit. Well, I would believe that, because I do believe that lots of New York Jews did go over to Russia when things started happening there. Practically every big American city is represented in the Bolshevik government of Russia. There is another full-fledged government waiting in this country for service whenever necessary. That is, I won't even try to explain that. The methods being adopted to get the land are such as will fill the world with indignation once the world fully understands what is being done. You know, then I think of the movie Exodus. That didn't come out until, the 50s or something. But it certainly did a job in making sure that any indignation about what was going on in Palestine, they were now Israel, was not seen. And instead we just saw all this great heroism of the Jews, and it was very, very effective. So what is being done, and that it is done with the knowledge and approval of the Zionist commissioner, is indicated by the fact that he suspended the activities of the British officer who endeavored to stop the abuse. It was the old game of lending money at an exorbitant rate of interest to people hard-pressed by war and crop failure, and then seizing their land when they could not pay. The bank that did this was the Anglo-Palestine Bank, a Zionist concern. This British officer, to save the people and the land, made arrangements with a British bank to lend them money at 6.5% with 5 years to pay. If payment failed, the land was to go to the government for redistribution, not to the Zionist bank. This was the humane plan which the Zionist commissioner forbade, whereupon the British officer resigned. Some effort was afterward made to redress the terrible act, But there it stands as the well-considered action of Jewry in power. So I thought that was very, very good, too. You know, they were just outwardly abusing these people to steal their land by, you know, making them need money, then lending them money in at exorbitant rates of interest, as we know they used to do in Europe, and then they couldn't pay it back, so they took their land. And this is, as the International Jew says, it stands as the way that Jewry in power behaves. Then follows what is described by every impartial observer as an arrogant attempt to expropriate everything in sight. Ha! In Russia, it could have been done very easily under the plea of nationalization. But there was Great Britain, whose laws to not condone, but there was Great Britain whose laws do not condone theft. The only schools that have been established in Jerusalem have been built and manned by the so-called Gentiles, although the Jews of Jerusalem have been the pensioners of worldwide Jewry for centuries. As long as 1842, Dr. Murray Machiani noted that the Jerusalem Jews cared nothing for schools because their children were only growing up into pensioners too. But Christians, with a warm regard for the holy city, set about to improve the miserable condition of the Jewish inhabitants. And thus it came that at the time of the Zionist invasion, a considerable number of Jewish children were in attendance at the schools. The newcome Zionist leaders demanded that the best of the schools should be given up to them. Of course, this was refused. You know, I just want to comment, going back to what was said in the beginning of this paragraph, that they wanted to expropriate everything in sight, the Jews. And it brought to my mind how everything in sight was appropriated from Germany by the Allies in 1945, and that very well could have been a Jewish idea, which they were encouraged to carry out, you know, because that's the way the Jews see it. Steal everything you can, everything in sight, and that's what they did. And now here they wanted these better schools to go only to their own children, or else not to have them, because they didn't want the Jews in Jerusalem, okay, the Jewish leaders didn't want the Jerusalem Jews to be well educated because they wanted them to be, ignorant and do what they're told to do by the leaders. That's what is meant here. So continuing with this story, it said that the British refused to turn these schools over to the Jews. And then the Council of Jerusalem Jews then caused it to be published in the Hebrew Daily that parents who did not withdraw their children from the schools would be punished. And now look at the typical punishments threatened. This is a list of the punishments. If any parent refused whose name was on the list of the American Relief Fund, the relief would be withdrawn. An interesting bit of news to subscribers to that fund. Doctors would be forbidden to visit the families that had children attending the enlightened schools. Their names would be sent to the blacklist at the places where circumcision was performed, so that newborn descendants of the recalcitrants might be refused the right of Moses. Well, you know, now I don't know that. Why can't they see through this? That they're told even that they're not going to be able to have the rights of Moses if they send their kids to this school. Continuing, they would be denied all share in Zionist benefits or funds. If they were in business, they would be boycotted. If they were workmen, they could get no work. It sounds familiar, doesn't it? Anyone who refused, let him know that it was forbidden. Now, this is a quote from what they wrote. Anyone who refused, let him know that it was forbidden for him to be called by the name of Jew. They will be fought by all lawful means. Their names will be put upon a monument of shame and their deeds made to reproach them to the last generation. If they are supported, their support will cease. If they are rabbis, they will be moved far from their office. They shall be put under the ban and persecuted, and all the world will know that in this justice there has been no mercy. Boy, that's good. You know, in the bottom line, in Jewish justice, there is no mercy. And this we find in the protocols. We absolutely do, where they talk about no mercy in their justice. And they talk like they're so superior in the hardness and the firmness of their justice. I think that came across to everybody without me commenting on it anymore. So I'll continue. It is the Jewish Bolshevist spirit all over again. That spirit which so many people have been vainly endeavoring to reconcile with the Russian temperament because it is so un-Russian. It is tyranny, and not the tyranny of strength, but of meanness and darkness. It is now perfectly clear what was meant by Dr. McInnes, who is Anglican Bishop of Jerusalem, when he said, quote, "The immigrants so far brought in to Palestine under the commission did not include many respectable English Jews, but they did include a great number of Russians, Poles, and Romanians, many of them thoroughly Bolshevik in their attitude to the government." Again, the Polish Jews, Russian and Polish Jews, are mentioned in this huge numbers of Bolshevik-type Jews, you know, the ones from Poland and Russia, and here they include Romania, too. If this spirit obtains at the beginning of a movement, which the Christian world has been taught by propaganda to regard as a profoundly religious and respectable exodus, it burdens the imagination to forecast what will be done in a period of full and unquestioned rule. Yeah, in other words, if this is what they do at the beginning, what the heck are they going to be doing at the end when they're in full control? Right? Observing and weighing the events and tendencies of Jewish rule thus far in Palestine, it is not difficult to see the purpose in it all. The Jews still distrust their ability to make a state. This is what they've come up with. They do not distrust the world's willingness to let them have a state. Indeed, it is amazing how naturally the Jews place confidence in that portion of the world they have always affected to despise. But deep-seated in the Jew is a distrust of himself. He doesn't know how his people will contrive to live together. I really love this. He doesn't know how they will contrive to drop the principles and practices which are so destructive of social comity elsewhere. And he feels that, patient as the mandatory power may be now, it is doubtful how long that patience will hold out under the blunders and brutalities that will be inseparable from Zionist rule, if any deductions can be drawn from the facts at hand. That is. So, you know, we can see already what kind of rule they will have, the kind of brutalities, and how long will others, or in this case they mean the British mandate powers, accept such behavior from them. So, therefore, feeling that the time may be short, he, the Jew, is endeavoring by such actions as interference with the cultural question, with the racial rights of the natives, and by such schemes as the land-grabbing device described above, to get so strong a hold on the situation as will seriously complicate it whenever Great Britain shall feel it to be her duty to the world to step in and attempt to bring some kind of order out of the chaos. That's more hopeful thinking, more wishful thinking about what, you know, what Great Britain and powers like the U.S. and so on will do about these things. But there's more about this. It begins to be very clear that Jewish nationalism will develop along the line of enmity to the rest of the world. Another great line. Jewish nationalism will develop along the line of enmity to the rest of the world. It was clear then. Already the dangerous proposal has been made to organize a Jewish army for the protection of the Suez Canal. A Jewish army. Instead of thinking of roads and farmsteads, of vineyards and oil presses, of schools and sanitary villages, the Jews are thinking of elevating themselves into the military power that shall stand between East and West on that most strategic strip of ground in the world. The whole situation is fraught with danger, and men who wish well to the Jews are alarmed and saddened by the prospect. There are three elements of danger in the situation as it exists today. The overwhelmingly predominant Bolshevik element that is being poured into Palestine. The intense egotistic and challenging nationalism that Zionists exhibit even before they get a potato patch. The taste for world politics and world power. And third, the racial confusion which now exists in Palestine. These combined are dynamite. The first is more vital than many realize. Already the Jews who have gone to Palestine at great sacrifice and for pious reasons are complaining that instead of the Psalms of David, the people are singing songs of the Red Revolution. And instead of meeting for instruction and prayer, there are riotous gatherings extolling Trotsky as Messiah and the Soviet as the Kingdom of Heaven. On the third anniversary of the Jewish Revolution in Russia, the streets of Jerusalem were placarded with sentiments of blasphemy and treason, and May Day this year was devoted to the exaltation of anarchy. This fact will be of interest to students of prophecy. It is as certain as any human forecast can be that this sort of thing will not be permitted to go forward in the face of the world. Oh, yeah? It is unimaginable that the nations responsible to humanity for the conduct of that important strip of territory will remain supine while Bolshevism spreads under the false pretense of a religious movement favored by Christendom. An attempt will be made to stop it. The Jews of Palestine will turn on their sponsor nation. The Jews of Russia will come down to help. Great Britain and perhaps the United States will defend the old pure vision of a Jerusalem redeemed. Then will come to pass the prophecy of Zechariah, and Judah also shall fight against Jerusalem. Judah also. It is a thought to make a Jew bethink himself where the lawlessness of the East and the materialism of the West will lead him against Jerusalem. What a terrible ending of Judah's present mad delusion. Well, there, you know, so many people at that time believed, well, people do today too, but it was probably more widespread, believed in Bible prophecies, or they were aware of them, and, you know, we're not surprised if they say, well, this is now, you always think these prophecies are happening in your time. that's very common. But in the end, none of this changes anything very much, and it doesn't. It doesn't mean what they people sometimes think, and it's not the end, and it's not going to bring about either an Armageddon or a change of thinking. What's happened is that we just kept going along. Jews just kept gaining. That's what happened. We know that today in hindsight. But to continue, Palestine has been called the center of the earth. It is. The power that controls Palestine controls the world. Although exercising no sovereignty over the land itself, Great Britain's control of adjacent waters and of Egypt and Persia and India forms the key of her power. All gone now. The white race has thus far been the chosen people to whom the dominion of the earth has been given. Palestine is the key to world military strategy and trade. In question 12 of the questions and answers published by the Department of Education, Zionist Organization of America, this occurs. Number 12, what are the commercial possibilities of Palestine? And the answer seems to be, the location of Palestine between three continents favors foreign trade. All this lends itself to dreams of future glory, and many Christian friends of the Jew have pleased themselves by conceiving a universal Hague at Jerusalem and a new social order going out to bless the nations from Zion. It is the idea conveyed by men like A.A. Burrell, Farrell, B-E-R-L-E, in books like The World Significance of the Jewish State. All this might be expected if the Jews of today were Old Testament people, anxious to reestablish the social laws of Moses, which are conceded to be the best safeguards ever devised against pauperism on the one hand and plutocracy on the other. There are some law. There is a law of Moses about you only own things. Is it for a certain amount of time? Every 20 years or something, everything starts all over again to keep some people from getting too rich and others too poor. It's something like that. That's what they're referring to. But Palestine has not fallen into the hands of that sort of Jews. Before the dream can be fulfilled, Judah must come to himself, as he has not yet, for from of old the word is, quote, and Judah also shall fight against Jerusalem. That's that biblical quote again, from Zechariah, I think. The racial situation in Palestine just now is very delicate. Americans do not understand it. The Zionist propaganda has always been accepted on the assumption that Palestine is the Jews' land and that they only need help to go back. It is an historical and political fact that Palestine has not been the Jews' land for more than 2,000 years. There are in Palestine 500,000 Muslims, 105,000 Christians, and 65,000 Jews. The industry of the land is agriculture. Engaged in this agriculture are 69% of the Muslims, 46% of the Christians, and 19% of the Jews. Small percentage there. Neither numerically nor industrially have they held the land, the Jews. Yet as the result of a war bargain, it is handed over to them, as regardless of the native inhabitants, as if Belgium had been handed over to Mexico. Many of the natives are Semites, like the Jews, but they do not want the Jews among them. That is a strange fact for those who use the term anti-Semitism. Why do real Semites also dislike the Jews? Surely Semites are not victims of anti-Semitism. The Balfour Declaration, as well as the terms of the mandate adopted at San Remo, recognize the rights of the native races. Indeed, everyone who knows about the people who have been native to Palestine for 2,000 years recognizes their rights, everybody except the Jews. Bethlehem was a Christian town, as befits the birthplace of Christ. Yet the Jews have contrived that 2,000 Bethlehemites leave Palestine rather than submit to what they see coming. The other races are not so placid about it, hence the trouble. It is now that the last clauses added as the Zionist historian declares, in order to appease a certain section of anti-Zionist opinion, begin to get a meaning for the reader. Was the purpose only to quiet disturbing questions until all the arrangements were made? This was that line that they added. Well, I'm going to confuse you if I confused myself. I'll just go on. Evidently, it was then a dishonest appeasement. Such may have been the Zionist intention, but no one need expect perjury on the part of the responsible nations. The end of the matter will see those last clauses redeemed by honest application of their terms to the people involved. General Allenby promised those native races of Palestine that their rights would be respected. So did the Balfour Declaration. So did the San Remo Conference. So did President Wilson in the 12th of his 14 points. But Judah says, let them get out. The last clauses were added in order to appease a certain section of timid anti-Zionist opinion. Let them get out, says Israel Zangwill. We must gently persuade, and this is a quote from Israel Zangwill, we must gently persuade them to trek. After all, they have all Arabia with its million square miles, and Israel has not a square inch. There is no particular reason for the Arabs to cling to those few kilometers. To fold their tents and silently to steal away is their proverbial habit. Let them exemplify it now. Unquote. Aside from the falsity of using the term Arab, there is the delightful Jewishness of it. Let them give it up to us. We want it. Americans have been in their land less than 150 years as a nation, and there is China and Arabia and Siberia for us to go to if we should want to, but we prefer our own country, and so do the native races of Palestine who have dwelt there for 2,000 years. The watchmen on the towers of the world are alarmed at what seems brewing in Judah's geographical cauldron. Well, what do you know? I finished it just in time. This was in the issue of May 28, 1921, the Dearborn Independent. And it really is very strong against how the Jewish power was behaving in and about and toward Palestine and their desire to have it. But the thing I think we can see today, that they have it and they have increased their, you know, there are these maps that show what land was given to the Jews in the very beginning and what was given to them in 46 and 47, and then how they have taken over almost all the land, and the Palestinians have just little tiny bit, and it's all separated and islanded left, and they do this, and the And what about all this opinion of the world? You know, what did the government of Great Britain, of the United States, or even now, you know, the governments of Europe, the European Union, what have they done? Nothing. They constantly fall for this, repeat this idea that Israel has a right to exist, you know, as though, you know, forget what's going on. In my opinion, the only solution is to go back to the beginning and undo all the wrongs that were done. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I carried this on without hatting tonight, and I hope I did all right. So please tune in again next week for another chapter along these lines. Good night.
Hooray, Jake, hooray, John, breaking up drinks all night long.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.